the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
So how does the mayor feel about gay people in Sochi?
We don't have them in our town.
You don't have them in the town. You sure? I went to a gay bar last night.
The U.S. committee has decided to put together a B-squad of less talented but undeniably heterosexual figure skaters.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said gays have nothing to fear in Russia.
You can feel free, relaxed, but leave children in peace, please.
This coming Friday, the Russian beach resort of Sochi will host the opening ceremonies for the 2014 Winter Games. Concerned over the host nation's human rights policies, including towards LGBT persons, has been a topic of heated discussion around the world. Well, what's the reality on the ground? And what's an appropriate expression of that concern? I'll be talking with the Reverend Pat Bumgardner, Executive Director of the Global Justice Institute in New York City.
If we are to build the groundswell here now, our first step, really, is about reclaiming the ability to dream big again. That aspirational world vision that is not about what we are fighting against, but what we are moving toward.
Valerie Carr is an award-winning filmmaker, civil rights advocate, and interfaith leader who centers her work around the power of storytelling. She is the founder of Groundswell at Auburn Seminary, a nonprofit initiative with 80,000-plus members that equips people of faith to mobilize for social change. Thanks both to a broad vision of what we all share and a deep commitment to the potential of technology to connect us with each other, Valerie will continue to be an influential leader, and she'll be my guest on this week's installment of our series titled A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, Where We're Going, How We'll Get There. I also have a few thoughts I'd like to share with you about President Obama's State of the Union address this past week. But first,
the Supreme Court is siding with a Catholic order of nuns, at least for now, over their objections to a provision of the health care law.
Well, I think the Supreme Court made a good decision. It's not a final ruling. It's not the definitive word.
Is this a precedent, though, that's going to have reverberations across Obamacare and for other organizations?
Well, let's hope so.
Last Friday, the Supreme Court granted a temporary exemption from the Affordable Care Act's reproductive coverage mandate to a group of Colorado nuns. No, it's not what it sounds like. But as a series of lawsuits make their way through the courts, the definition of religious liberty keeps getting more broad and more absolute. Patricia Miller has been providing great, insightful coverage of this issue on Religion Dispatches magazine. Patricia, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Would you start, please, by just summarizing the Supreme Court's action on the Little Sisters case last week?
What the Little Sisters are complaining about is the contraceptive mandate under the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, which states that all employers must provide free contraceptive coverage to their employees. There was a big dust-up over that mandate, and the Obama administration created a special exemption for religious employers like the Little Sisters, who aren't actually churches, but have some affiliation with a religion. The Little Sisters are claiming that even that mandate exemption is a violation of their religious freedom because they're required to sign a form that exempts them from the mandate. They're claiming that the signing of the form itself would make them complicit in the provision of contraception, which is forbidden by the Catholic Church.
And there are specific allowances within Catholic doctrine for functioning within the real world. You write that this ruling ignored that. Say some more about that.
The Catholic Church is not unreasonable and recognizes that Catholics have to participate in society just like everybody else. And sometimes that participation might touch on acts that the Catholic Church considers immoral. The most obvious example would be paying your taxes, and some of your taxes may go towards something that you don't agree with. For instance, if you were against the Iraq war as an unjust war, Catholics can still in good conscience pay their taxes because they're several steps removed from actually going to war in Iraq themselves. Catholics call that principle of moral theology cooperation. And there's actually 6 degrees of cooperation which are allowed by Catholics, from on one end things that are absolutely forbidden to on the other end things that are actually commonly done, as in paying your taxes. And what the Obama administration is asking the Little Sisters to do really falls on that very bottom end and very allowable end of cooperation with something the Catholic Church considers sinful.
Huh. Well, talk about the absolutism part of this discussion.
Well, what seems to have happened over the past 10 years with the Church, and these decisions in the modern world are largely guided by the Catholic bishops. They're the ones who kind of decide what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable, is they've really become much more absolutist in their thinking. And this isn't a coincidence or something that just happened because it happened. It happened because the Catholic bishops have really cracked down on this idea of cooperation, especially with any kind of woman's health care. They've taken a fairly flexible, commonly used area of Catholic moral theology and basically shut it down as an avenue for Catholic health care providers to reasonably cooperate with services that the Catholic Church may prefer to distance itself from.
Is it your impression that the Catholic bishops in the United States are committed to the same principle here as the religious leaders in Vatican City?
I think it's easy to draw a pretty straight line there, actually. There have been several cases in this country where Catholic health care providers have made what they felt were reasonable compromises to allow reproductive health services to continue at hospitals that they purchased. Mm-hmm. The most common area of contention is contraceptive sterilization, because that's an in-hospital service that's provided as part of the care in maternity wards. Very often women request a tubal ligation after they deliver a baby. The Catholic nuns who ran those hospitals were eager to find ways to do that without becoming too close to the actual provision of service, and would often come up with some creative solution to do that. For instance, having someone else come in and set up a little corporation to just do that part of the service they couldn't do. Several of those compromises were ended specifically at the behest of the Vatican. So there's little doubt that the Vatican has taken a direct interest in the application of cooperation to healthcare services in the United States.
Mm. Patricia, if you were the negotiator, the arbitrator in this debate, what would be a more reasonable way to approach it than is happening right now?
Well, it seems everyone would have to come at it really from a place of good faith, that you certainly want to protect people's religious freedom, and you don't want to have people directly perform a service that they are morally opposed to. We have those protections in the law, and that's a long-standing understanding of what the protection of conscience is in this country. But a good faith effort would also require people to recognize that women have a right to access routine services like contraception through their health care plan. That's not an unreasonable thing for someone to want to get through their health care provider. So it seems like there'd have to be a good faith effort on everyone's part to both protect conscience and make services available to women or to anyone who requires them.
One of the hesitations I have, and I don't disagree with what you've said, I don't necessarily trust the Catholic bishops to define religious freedom in the same way that the Constitution does.
I think that's a really, really good concern, and right now it's quite clear that they're not defining religious freedom in the same way the Constitution does, because the way they're defining religious freedom as their freedom to discriminate against others based on religious precepts, which really isn't the definition of religious freedom.
Right.
So that, I think that's a very reasonable fear about allowing the bishops to decide what is and what is not religious freedom.
Yeah. I'm really glad you said that. I don't know where I would have gone next if you hadn't agreed. What precedent does this potentially set for some of the other healthcare mandate lawsuits that are in the pipeline?
Well, the other big mandate lawsuits that are in the pipeline, the Hobby Lobby case is coming up in March, are even broader exemptions from the contraception mandate. They're looking for the right of any employer to refuse to provide contraception coverage to their female employees because they have a moral objection to contraception. That's a huge loophole that would really undo the past decade of progress in making contraception more accessible to women. And here you're allowing one person to use their religious or moral precepts, which obviously people are welcome to have, but not necessarily impose on other people, to decide what services someone should or should not get in a healthcare plan. The other obvious extension is they could use a very similar form of moral reasoning to refuse to provide health services or social services or even something as simple as an apartment to someone whose lifestyle they didn't agree with, such as a homosexual couple. They could say, my religion is against homosexuality, therefore I will not hire you, I will not rent to you. It really blows a big hole in everything we've come to accept as protections for individual religious freedom and individual rights.
When you're listening to Patricia and me talk, we're talking about what is really the cutting edge of religious freedom debates in our nation right now. For example, Patricia, as this is already implicit, but you also write about this long-term plan on the part of the Catholic bishops to effect change in U.S. policy on contraception. This is also going to come as a religious exception clause for debate.
That's correct. The Catholic bishops have been looking really for about the past 15 years to create very broad conscience rights to allow employers or hospitals or even pharmacists to not provide contraception because of moral or religious objections, which is really a very gigantic loophole when you think about it. This really coincides with the big push about 15 years ago to expand contraceptive access in this country, both to reduce the rate of unwanted pregnancy and also to somewhat level out women's health care expenses, which tend to be much higher than men's because of the price of contraception.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a long-term, ongoing strategy to use the rubric of religious freedom to shut down on contraceptive access just when public policy strides were being made to increase women's access to contraception.
Oh, that's well said. Patricia, how do you see this resolving itself in the long run?
Obviously, the Supreme Court's going to have a big say in what happens next. The Little Sisters case has not really gone all the way to the Supreme Court yet, even though they've issued a stay. It's still at the appellate court level. And the Supreme Court will rule on the for-profit question in March. If the Supreme Court rules for the for-profit employers and says they don't have to provide contraception to their employees, that will pretty much also cover the Catholic providers under that broad ruling. That would be a huge setback for women's health care in this country. I don't think people realize that they would basically be allowing bans on contraception that are doctrinal precepts that come from the Vatican determine whether or not women can get contraception through their health plan in the United States, even if they're not a Catholic. That's just a really unprecedented assault on personal rights and women's rights in this country.
You have a book coming out in May. Tell us a little bit about that.
My book is called Good Catholics, and it really is about this issue of reproductive rights and the Catholic Church. It tells the story of the development of the Catholic pro-choice movement, which many people may not realize there is a very vibrant Catholic pro-choice movement.
Mm-hmm.
Which developed in response to the bishops' anti-abortion activism over the past 40 years. And it really looks at how that activism has reshaped U.S. politics in ways that most people really aren't aware of, and U.S. health care in ways that most people aren't aware of.
Patricia Miller's writing on the Little Sisters case, as well as background on the work by the Catholic bishops to influence U.S. policy, is available at religiondispatches.org. Patty is past editor of Conscience Magazine and editor-in-chief of National Journal's Daily Healthcare Briefings. Thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, Weldon.
Later in the show, the Reverend Pat Bumgardner of the Global Justice Institute on the implications of the Winter Games taking place in Vladimir Putin's Russia. As a young activist, organizer, filmmaker, and public speaker, my next guest has made her mark both in the use of social media as founder of the Groundswell Movement website at Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, and in bringing inspiring stories to broader audiences with the medium of film. Regular State of Belief listeners will not have forgotten her reporting from Oak Creek late last year on the first anniversary of the shootings at the Sikh Gurdwara there, among her other appearances on the show. And I'm very pleased now to welcome Valerie Carr back to State of Belief Radio as part of our series, A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, Where We're Going, How We'll Get There. Valerie, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Walton. I'm so pleased to be back.
You know, it's hard not to think of you as a natural-born storyteller whose impulse toward that was crystallized in the aftermath of 9/11 and channeled into the medium of documentary film. Were you always a storyteller?
I was always a storyteller, and I think that is true because I was raised in a faith tradition where stories were so important. I grew up in the Central Valley of California on farmland that my grandfather had farmed starting in 1913 when he first arrived on U.S. shores from India. And so when I would go to school, I would open my history books and find really no mention of my family's ancestry, of our claim as Americans. I would also find no mention of my Sikh tradition or of my history in India. And so I became aware at a very young age, not just of the power of storytelling, because of course the stories I was told by my grandparents and parents in my household were incredibly important in shaping my identity, but I also became aware of the politics of storytelling. What did it mean that my family's and my community's stories weren't represented in the public sphere or recorded in our history books or in our newspaper headlines? And so that awareness of the politics of storytelling was something that I took with me into college. And when September 11th happened, it became a way for me to understand the tremendous fear and pain that all Americans experienced after 9/11, but in particular Sikh and Muslim Americans experienced after 9/11, when their stories of hate crimes and violence, racism, and discrimination were buried beneath the anthem of national unity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really a moment of my coming of age as an advocate, that I saw that my role was to help lift up those stories of my community into the public light, with the hope that it would be the starting point for healing as a nation.
The stories in your family, were they stories about family? Were they stories about religion? Were there stories about the nation? Or can you pinpoint them that way?
You know, it's really hard to distinguish between them because the stories I grew up with contained faith and nation and family. I grew up with stories of my faith, of the Sikh gurus standing up for a vision of oneness, of the unity between all people, all human beings, this idea of God as one, and of equality, that the fact that all of us were equal in the eyes of God because of this vision of unity, and this idea that we had to manifest this vision of unity through service, through serving and loving our brothers and sisters. And those values didn't come to me just through reading scripture. It was stories of faith, of people sacrificing themselves throughout Sikh history on the torture wheel, on fields soaked with blood to stand up for social justice. And so because that call to courage was so embedded in my understanding of my faith, it made sense that my grandfather, when he arrived and farmed the lands of California and saw his Japanese-American neighbors being shipped off to concentration camps, internment camps during World War II, that he could not stay silent. His faith would not allow him
to stay silent. He had to live out his faith by taking care of the farms of his neighbors. He was one of the very few who went to look after his neighbors and visit them at the concentration camps before they were allowed to return. And so I grew up with this notion of, you know, stories from hundreds of years ago, but also just a few decades ago here in the United States, that the way that we live into our potential as people of faith and the way that we live into our potential as Americans is to stand up for one another as we would have them stand up for us, to see ourselves in one another, and to put everything we have at risk for that greater call. I think that is what moved me out of my own paralysis and fear after 9/11 to try to walk in the footsteps of my foremothers and forefathers and take action after those terrorist attacks.
Valerie, tell me a story or two of the responses to your work that you've found particularly moving.
A few years ago, I had the opportunity to travel to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to report on the military commissions there. And I returned to my law school in Connecticut at Yale and realized that just a few miles away from my law school was a supermax prison that held people in conditions of solitary confinement that rivaled the ones that I saw at Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
I began to engage a team of law students in making a film about the supermax. But because I kept having the faces of the American soldiers I saw in Guantanamo in my mind, mm-hmm. I wanted to be sure that our film not only took seriously the stories of the prisoners, but also the stories of the correctional officers. And what we saw was correctional officer one after another talking about their struggles with PTSD, with alcoholism, with high suicide rates, so much so that you began to wonder how an entire prison could break down the spirits of people on both sides of the bars. And so suddenly, rather than creating a campaign that sought to demonize the people who held the keys, we crafted a film that really talked about what it said about our nation if we created an entire institution that sought to dehumanize every person who walked through its doors. That film became the worst of the worst. The title of the film is The Worst of the Worst. Upon its release in Connecticut, the Department of Corrections took the film seriously, and I think it's because of the stories of the correctional officers that we included. And the prison went from holding 400 inmates to now only holding several dozen. We are now traveling around the country with the film. Here, I'm speaking to you from California, where 30,000 inmates have protested their conditions of solitary confinement last year. And I'm proud to say the film is helping fuel a movement in states like California, like Connecticut, like Massachusetts, to rethink what we count as appropriate, as moral, for holding our nation's prisoners.
Oh, that's terrific. If I recall correctly, you were drawn into activism in response to some of the things that were happening to the sick American community. How did you find the commonalities that then drew you into the interreligious work that you do?
My coming of age as an advocate was after 9/11. I set out to make my first film called Divided We Fall about the hate crimes that erupted across the country against sick and Muslim Americans. And my goal was hopefully tell the country that these crimes were happening and that we ought to rethink our response to terrorism. We didn't want to let the terrorists win by letting ourselves compromise the very ideals that we stood for. So that was my goal.
Mm-hmm.
I then spent most of my 20s traveling around the country with the film, from universities to festivals to nonprofits to colleges and schools, 200 U.S. cities I traveled to living out of my suitcase, and what I discovered was transformative. One after another, the people in the audience would begin to stand up and tell their own stories. A Japanese-American woman in the back saying, "My grandparents were interned in World War II. Very few people stood up for them then. I will stand up for you now." I remember a gay man in New York standing up and saying, "Just as I have to fight for the right of LGBT folks to come out of the closet, I realize I have to fight for the right for Sikhs to wear their turbans." I remember an African-American man in in Nebraska standing up and pointing to his braids and saying, "My braids are my turban." I began to understand that this hunger, this thirst to be seen the way that we see ourselves is not something that just belongs to my family or my community, but it is really the story of every single community on America's shores. And that if I'm in the business of expanding the circle of who counts as one of us to include more and more of us, then I can no longer fight just for myself and my issues. That I felt compelled to lift up a broader movement for dignity and equality in America. And that led me to all the interfaith and intercommunity work that I've done. So I've worked with prisoners in supermax prisons. I've worked with African American youth stopped and frisked thousands of times before their 18th birthday on the streets of New York City. I've worked with Latino parishioners in the streets of East Haven, Connecticut, challenging racial profiling by local police officers. And I've worked with LGBT folks in their fight for marriage equality. And what I've seen in all of these communities is that it is the old way. It is the old way that we fight for our causes over and against one another. It is the new way. And more people in my generation are fighting this way to stand in solidarity around shared moral imperatives. And that's what gives me great hope for the future and how our stories can be used to show that and inspire that in the future.
So how did you get to Auburn Seminary and beginning the work of Groundswell?
So Groundswell first started in my tiny apartment living room in law school shortly after the controversy around Park 51, the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. I had friends gathered together trying to calm our nerves, really distressed by the ways not only how racism had exploded once again, but also the ways that the controversy inspired people to yell at one another from across the street, this kind of polarizing us versus them that we saw once more rear its ugly head. And so I had a group of young people who were LGBT, evangelical, African-American, Latino, Native American. We had people of all different faiths and walks of life and backgrounds gathered in that living room. This is just a picture of my friends. And we thought, okay, what can we do? And we looked at the tools that we have that our parents and our grandparents never had access to. These tools of social media that were no longer just dazzled by these tools or using them for self-expression, but that we could actually use these tools to organize in real and powerful ways, the ways that we're seeing people do in movements all around the country and the world. And so we had this idea of a multi-faith, multi-racial movement that lifted up this vision of a single, broader movement for dignity in America. Auburn Seminary became the perfect home for this vision, and through the incredibly talented leadership of my colleagues like Isaac Luria, we began to launch Groundswell. It now has 100,000 members, people of all different walks of life, joining campaigns for social change online to support their work on the ground.
We often read about modern technology, and the first words that come to mind are dehumanizing, depersonalizing. And in your work, I see just the opposite of that. How do we ensure that technology serves to connect us and not to separate us?
Oh, such a good question, Weldon. I think this is where the power of stories is central. So if we use media to share stories and to inspire thousands of people to stand behind those particular stories, to call for social change, it connects us in very real ways, even if it's all online. I'll give you an example. Shortly after the tragic mass shooting in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, inside of a Sikh Gurdwara, Harpreet Sani, a teenager whose mother was murdered inside of that Gurdwara, took his story to the halls of Congress. He became the first Sikh in U.S. history to testify, thanks to a team of advocates at the Sikh Coalition and other partners like Groundswell. We helped him with his testimony, and he brought the entire room to tears. He asked for the U.S. government to give his mother at least the dignity of being counted. Up until that point, Sikh advocates like myself had been asking the government for years since 9/11 to include Sikh and Arab and Hindu Americans as part of its hate crime statistics form. It had refused all of its crimes. But it took one young man's story to move Congress, to move mountains. And he could not just do it alone. We wanted to be sure that thousands of people were standing behind him. So we launched a groundswell petition where 4,000 people signed in support because they heard Fabrice's story. And a year later, last August, I'm really proud to report that President Obama announced that the FBI would be making this historic policy change for civil rights. So when I think about, you know, the great challenges that we have ahead, whether it's gun control or hate crimes or racial profiling, I think we need to draw from these examples of where stories combined with organizing can lead to lasting and concrete social change.
Valerie Carr is an award-winning filmmaker, activist, and founder of the Groundswell Movement Project at Auburn Theological Seminary. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio as a part of this series, A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, where we're going, how we'll get there, and you've just let us hear from a prophet.
Thank you, Wilson.
State of Belief would like to acknowledge the partnership of Auburn Seminary and the support of the May and Samuel Rudin Family Foundation in New York for the conversation with Valerie Carr on this week's show, a part of a month of conversations with faith leaders most likely to frame the critical justice debates of 2014. The Reverend Pat Bumgardner is the longtime senior pastor at the Metropolitan Community Church in New York, where her ministry encompasses serving the spiritual needs of the city's LGBTQI community. She has in recent years taken on the additional role of executive director at the Global Justice Institute. The Sochi Winter Games are set to begin this coming Friday. We've reached her at the annual Creating Change Conference in Houston, the largest gathering of LGBT organizers and leaders in the country. Pat, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
In the months leading up to the Winter Games, we've heard calls for boycotts, protests, and public opposition to Russia's stance on LGBT people. Is there anything people of goodwill can do?
Well, I think there are several things that people can continue to do. And before I say that, I just want to give people an example of the effect that signing petitions, that writing letters to President Putin, that posting pictures on the internet, that joining internet flash mobs, all those things have already had an effect. One group of politicians in Russia actually proposed that the language in that draconian law be changed from people being charged with propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations around children to the propagation of priority of sexual relations. And while we wouldn't support that law either, if that were to come before Russia's parliament and be voted on, it takes the focus off of LGBT people. I'm not naive about that. I don't think that having better laws necessarily means a society or a nation is safe for LGBT people. Brazil has marriage equality and also the highest rate of transgender murder in the world. But I do think it's an example of how international pressure can bring politicians to the table and force them to consider some kind of more just change. So I think that people can do many things. February 5th has been designated as a day of action, and I would really encourage people to do a couple of things. You can go to www.allout.org, and they've organized a number of things, including petitions that can be signed. Sometimes you think you're just adding your name to something, but as I just pointed out, it can make a real difference. There's an opportunity there to schedule some kind of event supporting LGBTI people in Russia and to take photos of that and have it posted on their website. And I think all of those things are very, very important. I also want to lift up the value of contacting journalists and encouraging them to letters to the editor, that kind of thing, to ask the right questions when they're in SOCI. And the value of targeting corporate sponsors like Coca-Cola and McDonald's and Visa. There are people who are calling for people of goodwill to give up their Visa cards and switch to MasterCard or Amex or something like that. So I think there are many, many ways that people can send a message that they stand with LGBTI people and human rights overall, and that they call for a society where all people have equal protection under the law. You know, people say that the Olympics is non-political, but that's not really true. You know, the Olympics has been a forum in which women's equality has been on the table for a long, long time. In Mexico City, 1968, two men, you may recall, stepped to the podium and had black gloves on their hand and put their fists in the air to protest racial inequality in the United States. South Africa was banned from the Olympics over the issue of apartheid. So it's not true that the Olympic Forum is an apolitical context. In fact, the International Olympic Committee has taken both moral and just stands around things like apartheid.
Pat, talk a little bit about what life is like for LGBT Russians since the passage of that country's anti-gay laws.
Of course, as in any country, it doesn't affect everyone equally. But we do know that there have been young men, for example, who have been targeted and beaten. We do know that there have been some people brought up on charges of violating the law because simply holding up a sign like "Love Wins" or that kind of thing. And I think the more importantly than the cases where there's, you know, extreme violence or somebody is arrested, is just the way it impacts ordinary, everyday life with people living in fear that somehow they'll be targeted or that somehow because they're walking down the street with their same-sex partner and their child that they could lose custody of that child. I mean, just the level of anxiety it raises for people when you know that you're not protected in the country you live in, and in fact, you could become a target. I think it's an unbearable way to live.
I can't figure out what happened here. Did somebody just drop the ball, the international community, the Olympic Committee, someone else? What's your take on that?
You know, that's a good question, and people have been trying to analyze this. You know, if you look back a little bit, when Sochi was awarded the Games, the concerns were largely environmental or security. Mm-hmm. And then many people say that Putin became a target by the Western conservative evangelical community, and that he knew that as a member of the Council of Europe, he could not recriminalize LGBT life because queer life was decriminalized in Russia in the early 1990s. But because he wanted to build a fast and strong relationship with the conservative religious movement, and specifically in Russia with the Orthodox Church, he came up with these ideas about not allowing outsiders who are LGBTI identified to adopt Russian children and this propagation law. And, you know, he's continued to promote these laws around the proposition of protecting children, which if you look at the rise of this conservative religious power around the globe, that's always the place they focus in on, protecting children. And, you know, the mayor of Sochi has said, you know, as long as you leave our children alone, you'll be okay. I mean, it's really kind of a ridiculous proposition. But I think in my heart and mind, what it's about is political power and political alignment, in this case for Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. The work of the Global Justice Institute, of course, extends far beyond Russia and even Eastern Europe. Would you just kind of summarize where you're working around the globe?
I'll just concentrate on this past year since that's the most immediate things for us. In addition to Russia, and I just want to say that one of the things that we're helping to sponsor there is the work of an MCC clergy person who has gone underground to provide spiritual support for the LGBTI community there, which can't be underestimated. People are hungry for even underground spaces where they can find support for their lives and believe in the power of God's love at work with them. It really feeds their ability to do the activism they're called to do. But in addition to that, we're working in Nigeria, where also, you know, we've seen the rise of hateful legislation once again, where people even showing any kind of advocacy for human equality can be imprisoned for up to 14 years. We're working with some folks on the ground to support a safe house in western Nigeria and providing some of the funds to get people to that safe house. We're working in Uganda, supporting groups on the ground to, again, fight a bill there that in some cases would send people to jail for life. This past year, we got a group called the United Coalition for Affirming Africans off the ground in Kenya. And, again, that creates a safe space for clergy people who may not agree with our position that LGBTI people are God's people and our sexuality is not a sin, but who also don't want to advocate for violence against people, creating a safe space for them to come together and find support in issuing a different kind of message from the pulpit. We've been working in Costa Rica with a project called Humanitas and a shelter there, Casa de Esperanza, and a project called La Carpa, where people come together, all kinds of people, housed, unhoused, street people, people living with AIDS, people not living with AIDS, to share breakfast and information about HIV and AIDS and the belief that talking to people across the barriers that normally separate us can bring social change. We're also working on an issue that we title Eradicating Human Trafficking. As you may know, trafficking in human life or slavery is probably the third largest enterprise around the globe today. And so here at Creating Change, where I am today, we're offering a workshop on how people can take initial steps in identifying and eradicating human trafficking in their local communities.
Pat, I just have to tell you, I only ask, and you are only going to talk about a year, and that sounded like a decade or a half a century of work. And it's an amazing, amazing agenda of work. How can our listeners, I always want to know this, how can our listeners learn more out about the Institute and help you in your work? Tell us that, please.
Okay, thanks so much for asking that. You can go to www.globaljusticeinstitute.com, and you can make contact with us through that website. You can also donate to our work through that website. And I want to say to people that you can specify how your donation is spent. And at this point in time, every drop of cash we receive goes to work on the ground. We keep nothing for overhead. So you're guaranteed that your money will go where your heart is. And I want to say in advance, thank you to everyone who has supported our work. If you want to write to me personally, for example, if you have an idea that you want to implement in your community, or if you want to be part of one of the teams we have in the United States around public policy, you can write to me at rvpatmccny@aol.com, and that will come directly to my desk, and I'll answer your email.
The Reverend Pat Bumgardner is Executive Director of the Global Justice Institute, Senior Pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church in New York City, a good friend of State of Belief Radio. Pat, your work is as ambitious as it is vital, and as always, it's great to have you share an update with us here on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your will.
Now, before we go, a few thoughts about the State of the Union address this past Tuesday. The State of the Union address took place in an environment perhaps best characterized by a tweet from a Texas congressman before the speech ever began. He wrote, "On floor of House, waiting on Commandant in Chief, the socialist dictator." Huh. So there's that. But in a rhetorically superior address filled with energy, the president spoke for over an hour on what he considers the most pressing issues in our nation at the present moment. Most interesting, if not stunning to me, was the complete absence of any reference to most of the issues that we discuss most regularly on State of Belief Radio. The loudest silence was the absence of an affirmation of religious freedom as defined in our Constitution. Right now, the First Amendment is under assault because of the wishy-washy treatment that the White House has given to attempts to change the meaning of religious liberty, alter the assurance that all religions, like no religion, will be treated equally, compromises in the White House's position on religion and the funding of faith-based ministries. The State of the Union never will be secure or good as long as the status of the constitutional provision of religious freedom is not totally secure. This is our first freedom, the cornerstone of our democracy, the uniqueness of our equality and vision of the importance of minorities. Eternal vigilance is still necessary in the protection of religious freedom, but more is needed. Watching is no longer enough. Both the highest leaders of our government and the most detached citizens in our republic must act to defend, strengthen, and promote religious freedom. You know, it would have been encouraging and reassuring if this past Tuesday evening President Obama could have at least given even a nod to religious freedom so that all would know that its protection is among his highest priorities. There was a deafening, unsettling silence about religious freedom that told us something more about the state of our nation. I know commentators have been largely favorable toward the president's performance, but in a conversation with the producer of this show, Ray Kirstein, we are in agreement there still was that lack of passion about vision. I think we're most sensitive to that because we've been doing this series on a prophetic vision for a new year. If you compare what we've been hearing from a Baptist, a Catholic, a UCC, and a Sikh, each one holds true to their own faith tradition, but I never heard one partisan, that is, denominationally exclusive, word. Instead, I heard an ambitious, unifying vision grounded in morality that welcomes and would be welcomed by people of any faith or of no faith. I think that's profound. As the level of rhetoric on Capitol Hill regrettably continues to devolve, it's profoundly hope-giving to have inspired leaders step forward to take up the slack. And we're not talking about proselytizing here, far from it. You think Sister Simone Campbell would care if you wished her happy holidays instead of Merry Christmas? You think the Reverend William Barber would welcome you any less to a Moral Monday protest if you came directly from a Right to Life rally? These folks don't have time for the culture wars or partisan bickering. So, you know, maybe it's ultimately a good thing that our political leaders are occupied by petty squabbles and electoral priorities because the adults are stepping up to fill the void. And their vision of a better future for all of us is vivid, clear, indeed what we need. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We can only produce this show with the generous support of listeners like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution to support this show today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem even to exist. stateofbelief.com is where you can find out more about the show. hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show. Stay in touch with us, please. You can do so throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen along with you. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.